Thank you, everyone, for coming out tonight. I want to start by just one more hand-raising activity because it's a rule of threes, and we only did two. A lot of you are new here. How many of you here have some sort of personal connection to mental health or mental illness? Either you work in the field, you yourself are struggling with mental health issues, you have a relative or a friend. Quite a few here today. Thank you. So yeah, I think mental health is one of those issues that touches everyone. It kind of knows no class, no gender, no race, no geography, as we saw with all the hands raised up to here. So I've been really excited to get this panel. I like to joke, this is like my dream dinner party panel, but I'm a bit of a dork. You know, we do cover mental health issues on stateside quite considerably, and so I'm really thrilled to be here to talk in a more informal setting. A couple facts. Michigan has a $2.6 billion Medicaid behavioral health system. We spend $2 billion a year on prisons, which is nearly one-fifth of the general fund. And lastly, in saying all that, I do want to preface this with, we could have a three-day symposium on the issues about the mental health system in Michigan. We have an hour and a half. And I need to leave time for your questions. So we are not going to get to everything tonight. Let me just leave that as a caveat. But we're going to try and move around. We have a great panel, and I'm going to introduce them. On my far right is Bob Sheehan. He's the CEO of the Community Mental Health Association of Michigan, which represents more than 150 organizations that provide mental health and other services to more than 300,000 Michigan residents. Before his current role, Bob was the CEO of the Community Mental Health Authority of Clinton, Eaton, and Ingham counties. Next on my right is Kevin Fisher. He's the executive director of NAMI Michigan. The National Alliance for Mental Illness on Mental Illness is the nation's largest grassroots mental health organization dedicated to improving the lives of persons living with serious mental illness and their families. A retired businessman, Kevin joined NAMI as a volunteer in 2011, shortly after losing his oldest son, Dominique, to suicide. Kevin has been the executive director of NAMI Michigan since 2014. And just to my left here is Jane Schenk. She is the executive director of the Association for Children's Mental Health. ACMH provides support, information, and education for families raising children with emotional, behavioral, and/or mental health challenges. Her son, Jonathan, has struggled with mental health issues, so she also comes at this with a personal point of view. And to tease it out, her son, Jonathan, is in his last semester in college in California getting his aerospace engineering degree. That's what recovery looks like. Anyway. And lastly, on my far left here is Judge Milton Mack. He is Michigan State Court Administrator. Before his appointment to that role in 2015, Judge Mack served as a judge for the Wayne County Probate Court from 1990 to 2015. 98 to 2015, he was a chief judge. He's a member of the Conference of State Court Administrators and was the author of its 2016-17 policy paper entitled Decriminalization of Mental Illness, Fixing a Broken System. He currently serves as a member of Governor Snyder's Mental Health Diversion Council. Give a hand for our panel, please. So to kick things off, I just want to get, just give me a couple adjectives to describe this. So, Jane, I want to start with you. How would you describe what it's like to be a Michigan parent with a child who has a mental illness?
Well, I think at first I would say it depends on where you live in the state of Michigan and if you have public or private insurance and a whole lot of other factors. Having said that, I think some of the adjectives would be confusing and scary, sometimes hopeless, isolating, sometimes stigma-laden, and on the other hand, sometimes promising and hopeful and positive with the right supports and services. Some of those weren't adjectives.
We're not counting.
Okay.
Judge Mack, how would you describe what it's like to be caught up in Michigan's criminal justice system if you have a mental illness?
Frustrating. But I would say this, if you're, ironically enough, if you're caught up in the criminal justice system, your chances for getting mental health treatment are probably better than if you're not in the criminal justice system. One of the sad ironies of what's going on here in Michigan.
And Bob, how would you describe what it's like to be a service provider at one of the community mental health authorities across the state right now?
When I talk to most of them, selfless, courageous, hopeful, and resource-starved, I think. Those are the four I'd use.
And Kevin, lastly, what's it like to be a Michigan resident who's trying to get mental health services for themselves?
You know, I guess I'd say confusing, frustrating. But as Jane said, if you're in the right place at the right time, it can be hopeful and uplifting. So geography plays a serious role. But overall, the system is still very frustrating and difficult for people to understand and navigate.
So there's a bit of themes here, frustration, difficulty, confusion. One of you put this in context. Is Michigan any better off or worse off than any other state, Judge Mack?
We're no worse off than anybody else. It's not going well anywhere across the country. For example, persons who are charged with a crime and who are alleged to be mentally ill, well, the forensic hospitals across America are all full. They're all full. There are no beds. The forensic patients are now taking up what are called the civil beds. So like in Maryland, 80% of the people who are admitted to the civil beds are from the forensic center. And what's happening is we're seeing misdemeanants being sent to the forensic center because district judges say, well, at least they get some mental health treatment. So it's really a pretty sad situation.
So why is this so hard to fix if the sentiments are the same across the board? Kevin, what's the biggest barrier?
Politics. Stigma. A desire to understand the system, where it's strong and where its shortcomings are, to name a few.
Jane?
Kind of tagging on to that, I would agree that stigma is a huge barrier. I think in the world of kids and families, another piece is, you know, systems don't work together. So you have, in the kid world, schools, and you have the public mental health system, and you have maybe juvenile justice system, and each of those systems is kind of in their little silo. And so they're not necessarily working together. And often it's up to the parent to try to pull those things together, and they're already pretty overwhelmed and pretty confused.
I would add that pass the buck comes into play here, because the back in the 60s, mental health systems were public mental health systems. And then the Community Mental Health Act in 1963 essentially helped convert the public mental health system into what became a Medicaid mental health system. So unless you're poor and on Medicaid, you can't get help. The system waits until you are homeless or incarcerated to help you out. So what legislatures did in the 60s and 70s was get federal funding to take care of persons who were Medicaid eligible, reduced access to people who weren't Medicaid eligible, and at the same time reduced funding, the general fund funding, for all other persons. So we've seen cutbacks in funding at the state and federal and local level steadily going on for the last several decades. And so now there isn't enough money in the system to do what needs to be done.
Let me jump in, if I could, Joe.
Please do.
We're a sophisticated audience, and I think we can hold two truths simultaneously. There's some really great stuff happening out there. I mean, there are people's lives that are being turned around because of the mental health system. Judge Mack said is right. If you're a Medicaid recipient, you get the most comprehensive set of mental health services anywhere in the country. That truth is sitting side by side with the fact that there are some lives that are a wreck because they can't get in. If you're not on Medicaid in Michigan, let me just give you a fact. There's $7.50 per person in Michigan not on Medicaid available for your mental health care. $7.50. We might as well go out and buy lunch for everybody and be done with it, right? So that's a concern. And I think what happens is a lot of our communities think the safety net still exists for all of us without Medicaid care. It does not. And it hasn't for a decade or more. That's true in every state, by the way. Almost every state has said, let's let Medicaid pay for it because the feds pay in Michigan about 2/3 of the cost. We all would do that. And they've walked away from their obligation. So I got to be clear. I guess I defend the CMH system. I think it's a great system. It really is quite tremendous. Changing 300,000 lives a year. And their families. So over 1 million folks in Michigan have their lives improved. However, it's poorly resourced. There's a lot of, as Jane said, a lot of confusion here. And as Kevin said, the stigma's large. And one sentence and then I'll stop, I promise, Joe. So there was a shooter, as you know, out in California 2 days ago at Facebook, YouTube, right, exactly. And the quote in the paper that I saw in the news going across was, she had a history of violence and had sought mental health care. And, of course, what I wanted to say, and saw a dentist and shopped at the grocery store, too. Right? Thanks. Any applause is good. Keep it up. Because talk about stigma, meaning somehow seeking mental health care made her a shooter, right? Really? No. That's that terrible science the public does, is they say there's a correlation. You could say she was a woman, too. So women are all shooters, or folks who grocery shop are all shooters. So it's important we use better science than what gets picked up in the story.
And I think some of this larger public discussion we're having, even in the last few months, about mental health and violence, arguably is part of why we're here tonight. I want to kind of take us through some of the entry points to the mental health system and look at that a little bit, starting with early intervention. Jane, you work with families. How important is early intervention for the family and also for the individual?
Yeah, well, I think it's, first off, a point that you made, Joe, that's really vital here is with kids and with youth, you can't just treat them in isolation. You can't just give them the services. You have to work with the whole family because, newsflash, kids are part of a family. And so you have to provide all of the services and supports so that the family, the parent, the caregiver is an equal member of the provision team. You got to take their hopes and their preferences and their wishes and their culture into account. So having said that, back to the piece of early intervention, priceless. The research shows that the earlier that you can provide the services and supports and get treatment for a kid, the better outcome you're going to have for a lot of reasons, both for their mental health, for their social development, for their ways of integrating into the world. And really, I think one of the first places with a kid, there's two, that you're going to start to see a parent searching for answers is in the school and with a pediatrician or a primary care physician. And neither of those are really mental health providers. So right there, we kind of have a little bit of a gap and a little bit of a problem.
And I was just going to ask you about gaps. But first, what is out there currently now for parents in Michigan to seek help? What options do parents have?
Like I say, a lot of times you go to your primary care provider, your pediatrician. A lot of times we hear things where the pediatrician actually turns to the parent and says, I'm not really sure what to do here, so why don't you go see CMH? Which may or may not be an adequate and appropriate sort of a referral. The kid might be in school, and so maybe the teacher will be the first one to contact the parent and say, you know what, I think we have a little bit of a problem here. 9 times out of 10, what you'll hear is, so here's a better parenting techniques and classes for you so that you can better parent and raise your child. Because, again, we don't have an acceptance that kids have mental health challenges. So those are two of the pieces that are out there. And if, again, if your child has private insurance, your options are going to be pretty limited depending on where you live and what's available there.
Kevin, what do you hear from parents?
The frustration and the gap. And, you know, going with what Jane said, we know that 50% of all lifetime cases of mental illness onsets by the age of 14. The problem is, in the schools, that child gets labeled a problem child rather than exploring whether or not there's an underlying issue like mental health or trauma in the home. There could be many issues there that don't get explored. And I kind of, I take it back to the stigma, because mental illness should be treated like any other physical illness. And again, with what Jane said, for any physical diagnosis, early diagnosis and treatment leads to better outcomes. That applies to mental illness as well. The stigma gets in the way, and forgive me, you're going to hear me use that term stigma a lot, because when I look at all of the issues out there, whether there's funding, access to beds, all of those things, all of them tie back to stigma for me. And if we can change the culture, the way we look at mental illness, and treat it with, and I'll use the term respect, respect the mental health diagnosis as we would cancer or heart disease, then we eliminate that barrier and people get to the help that they need.
Bob, what about from your point of view on the service provider side? What's out there for families and children, and how would you describe it?
Well, I think what's always surprising is people don't have a sense of what's there until they need it. I mean, most people don't explore it ever until they need it. And as we've said, it's kind of hidden. So if you have a Medicaid card and you're severe enough, unfortunately, you have to be pretty severe to be seen by the CMH system. You get a really good package of wraparound services, home-based care. If you're a kid, psychiatry, residential, drop-in, a number of jargony words, but there are all kinds of ways that are traditional and non-traditional to treat it. If you have commercial insurance or you're uninsured, you're kind of on your own. So let me be sort of clear. There was a parity law passed in the state at the federal level requiring that insurance parity, insurance for mental illness be on par with physical. But it's not. So, for example, if you pull out your insurance card now, if you have commercial insurance, you get pretty much only outpatient office-based psychotherapy, psychiatry, meaning medication, or inpatient psychiatry, period. Nothing else. And I'll have lots of parents call the CMHs and say, how do I get my kid or young adult or brother or husband into that program? And we say, you can't, because the insurance company won't pay for it. I think folks are stunned by that. In physical health care, commercial insurance tends to be a lot better than Medicaid. In mental health care for the severely impaired, Medicaid is a far better service. So there are some huge gaps, Joe, that most people don't know till they come to that part in the road and the bridge is out. That's when they realize the bridge is out.
Well, and if I could jump in for a minute, a lot of what Bob was just talking about that's missing is what we call wraparound services. So it's not just getting your medication. It's not just seeing a psychiatrist. It's not just going to therapy. But it's the social supports that you have. So you feel like a viable part of your community. Is there job training available? Is school available? Is your places of worship involved? Because faith is one of those things that's a big gap. A lot of people struggle with faith and mental illness. They feel that they won't be accepted at their place of worship. They feel that they don't feel comfortable going to their faith leaders and talking about it. So they find themselves in a situation where either I have to choose. I have to choose whether or not I want to get mental health services, or I have to choose my faith. And that shouldn't be true. And that's just one example. But those wraparound services improve the overall quality, not only of that person's life, but the life of everybody in the community. And that's what we have to focus on as well.
Thanks. Just to one note, there are efforts around the state on this interfaith training and training imams and ministers and priests on some of this frontline counseling or activity. Yep. On referrals. It's we've talked to a number of people. That's an effort that's underway. Go ahead, Jane.
I think one other piece that we're pretty fortunate to have in Michigan through our public mental health system is a good series of peer supports, which there's nothing quite as unique and supportive, something that gives hope and reduces isolation quite as much as talking to somebody else who says, I've been there. So in our public mental health system, we have adult peers. We now have peer parents. And as of about a year ago, we have youth peer support providers. And I think this is really also changing the trajectory. It's really helping folks engage in and own their own treatment to find their voice and to truly be empowered. And we're seeing this, like I say, change the trajectory and impact really their entire recovery process.
So we've talked about early intervention, and there are some programs available, but I think we heard everyone say there are some pretty wide cracks. And if you slip through the crack, those cracks, we as Judge Mack mentioned, you end up in the criminal justice system.
Well, the truth is that while there are good things going on, the situation is getting worse. It is getting worse. The number of people in prison because of mental illness is increasing. This is despite the fact that the Supreme Court and the State Court Administrative Office have developed an aggressive program for developing problem-solving courts, including mental health courts. And despite the proliferation of mental health courts, the tide of people with mental illness filling our prisons and jails continues to grow. Frankly, our prisons and our jails have opened their doors to people with mental illness. It's time for the mental health system to open its doors to persons with mental illness. The problem is we intervene too late. You know, unless you're, if you're an adult, if you're not homicidal or suicidal, we're not going to step in and help you. So we see the train going down the tracks. We know the bridge is out. We can call the engineer and say, better stop the train. Or we could park ambulances at the bottom of the ravine and pick up the dead and wounded. Well, we pick up the dead and wounded. That's how it works, because we have a system that does not permit intervention in a timely way. And until we convert our mental health laws to align with current treatment, it's not going to work. We live in a world of outpatient treatment, but we have a mental health code that's focus is on stopping involuntary hospitalization. That's like trying to stop you from getting hit by lightning. Yeah, try to get into a hospital these days. I mean, that's a low risk.
And those, the mental health code you're referring to, I mean, that dates back decades.
1974.
Exactly.
And what that code, Michigan's code, is a lot like every other state, that when the legislature realized that if we close mental hospitals, we can have the federal government pay for the cost of taking care of indigent persons with mental illness. See, the law provided in 1963 that the federal government would pay for the cost of care if they weren't in the hospital. This created a huge financial incentive to close hospitals. So in order to close the hospitals, you got to get the people out of the hospital and keep more people from getting in. So these very restrictive mental health codes were adopted in the 70s to basically make it very difficult to order involuntary mental health treatment. I suspect that was in part because people didn't believe there was a reliable treatment for mental illness at that time. But today there is. We live in the recovery era where mental illness is treatable, that early intervention is preferred. And if we intervene early, people with mental illness can recover and can lead productive, satisfying lives. So we need to fix our laws, and we need to fund mental health treatment.
And kind of advancing that, Judge, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the one solution that you brought up in your white paper. It has a bit of an academic title to it, you know, sequential intercept model. Hold on. Don't glaze over yet. It's interesting. you know, sequential intercept model that requires some of these changes to the health code. But give a sense of why you think this, if we implemented this, could really help solve some of the warehousing we have of people with mental illness in our jails and prisons.
Well, the sequential intercept model addresses taking people out of the criminal justice system or helping them transition out of the criminal justice system once they get in it. So step one, if you have someone who's arrested, divert them to a problem-solving court. Step five would be if you have someone who is in jail or in prison, you want to transition them out, you transition them out into treatment. So it's a matter of along each step along the way, you intervene to try to address the mental illness. And just to show you how the flaws in it right now, let's say I've got someone in the mental health court, and they do well, they graduate. All right, they graduate, now they're on their own. They're no longer supported by the mental health system. Well, they weren't actually in the first place, but they got the mental health treatment in the mental health court. And if you're in a mental health court, you're going to get an array of services that most people don't get unless they're in the mental health court. But once you're out of the mental health court, what happens if you begin to decompensate and you need help? Well, we have to wait. We have to wait until you get yourself in some serious trouble. Then we can intervene. Why do we wait? If a person has a mental illness and because of that mental illness loses the ability and the capacity to make an informed decision, why do we step in then? Why don't we step in and help them get well then and avoid all the consequences of untreated mental illness?
What changes to the mental health code do we need?
Well, you start with the standard for intervention. So I believe that the mental health code should provide that if a person has a mental illness and because of that mental illness has become incapacitated, unable to make an informed decision, then the court should be in a position to order treatment, preferably outpatient treatment. And that's something you can do if you intervene early. And I think it starts there. And that part is fairly controversial, but that's where it starts. The fact is, that's the same standard we use to appoint a guardian for somebody. So in Michigan, a probate judge can appoint a guardian for someone because they're mentally ill, but the guardian cannot consent to mental health treatment, even if consenting to mental health treatment would mean the person wouldn't need a guardian anymore. So the guardian can consent to amputation, cancer treatment, and end-of-life decisions, but the guardian cannot consent to mental health treatment that would terminate the guardianship by restoring the person's capacity. And I think that is illogical and ridiculous and cruel.
Go ahead, Bob.
If I could just... So it's always a debate between civil liberties and protecting somebody, right? That's always... So Judge Mack and I have this discussion all the time. Because we always want somebody else to be forced into treatment, but we don't want me to be forced into treatment. We all believe that, by the way. And I have my own list of people I want forced into treatment. And mostly based on how they vote. But aside from that... But Judge Mack is right. There are moments where everyone looks around and says, oh my God, his life's fallen apart. So I think one of the things we're learning is how do you balance civil liberties with forced treatment? And in something that Kevin said, in non-traditional care... I must get two calls a week from parents saying, oh, my God, my 24-year-old son is making terrible decisions. You know what he needs is a case manager. Seriously. But he's not seriously enough. I mean, most of 24-year-old males I know need a case manager. And an awful lot of things would go away. Seriously. Crime rates would drop. Unwanted pregnancies would drop. Drug use. Really, if we just had an adult counterpart. It's a non-traditional thing. If we broaden the mental health technology we have to say a lot of people would get it, first mom and dad would drag that 24-year-old in by their ear, but then that young person would say, this is pretty cool. I know I learned how to make friends. I can balance my checkbook. I know how to get a job. I'm not living in my parents' basement anymore. Really, those are the things that before that person's life falls apart. Because once you've, I don't know if you've seen the research, but your first stay in a psychiatric inpatient facility, an inpatient means you're going to have that happen more often. If we can avoid that first one, not by keeping you out of the hospital when you need it, but by providing services early on we can help you in your entire life. You may never end up in a psychiatric facility. But once you get in that habit and that pattern, your life, you also get stigmatized and labeled pretty badly. So as always, again, civil liberties, early intervention, and forced treatment are always in a mix. Like in any civil society, you have to debate three or four goods at once.
And one of the aspects of this is called, we call it Kevin's Law in Michigan, but it's really assisted outpatient treatment. And assisted outpatient treatment works. And New York State has done a lot of work on this. They've had a lot of cases where they have people who are placed in assisted outpatient treatment orders. And they've measured how the persons felt about the treatment they got. And the way they felt about the treatment was dependent on if whether they were treated with dignity and respect. It didn't matter if it was involuntary or voluntary, because you used both of them. So whether you're voluntary or involuntary wasn't the issue. It was, were you treated with dignity and respect? And so as long as you, if you have an assisted outpatient treatment order and you make sure the person is treated with dignity and respect, you're going to get a good outcome. But the outcomes in New York have been stunning. The rates of hospitalization drop, rates of arrest drop, rates of homelessness drop, rates of self-care improvement increase. Nearly every measure you can think of is a positive outcome. Was it difficult to understand why there'd be any resistance to something that works so well?
What kind of resistance?
When Kevin's Law was first proposed here in Michigan, there was a lot of resistance by those who, I would suggest the civil libertarian side, a lot of resistance on that side. And that resistance has evaporated for the most part. But there's still resistance to it, even in the mental health community. So I've advised probate judges, when you're entering orders for treatment, make them 180-day outpatient orders. And there's a sense that why should we put a person... Now, there's a sense, on the other hand, by some in the psychiatric community, that we should not put people on orders who don't belong on orders. And I agree with that. But at the same time, I feel there's too much caution on the side of not treating versus treating. It seems to me that if you have someone who is incapacitated by mental illness, you should err on the side of treating instead of not treating.
What do you think, Kevin?
Well, and this is personal for me, because I didn't know of Kevin's Law in 2009, 2010, when my son decided to withdraw from treatment. And I didn't know that that was a tool that was available to me to help him, because at that time, and I really commend Judge Mack, and I think I've been blessed to have the opportunity to work with him and see the evolution of Kevin's Law and still what's to come. But I'll give you a real quick. So Dominique was 23 years old, and he decided to not participate in his treatment program. He stopped taking his medication, moved out of my house, stopped going to therapy. I went to probate court and tried to get an order. They said, I mean, it's the exact example is what Judge Mack described. When I explained that I was trying to get guardianship to take control of his mental health care, I remember the clerk saying, this is not what's going to help you. You're not going to get to where you want with this order. So I remember going back to his where he was receiving treatment and literally begging the psychiatrist. I said, can we hospitalize him for 30 days just to get him stabilized again? Dominique was diagnosed bipolar schizophrenic, and I knew he was in a bad place. And each time I made that request, they said, unless he presents as a danger to himself or others, we can't hospitalize him. Now, I'm not involved at that time as an advocate the way I am now. So all of this was like fighting in quicksand. It seemed like the harder I fought, the faster I sank. But I recall being very frustrated and literally to the point of tears with his doctor. I said, let me make sure I understand. He has to fail at killing himself or somebody else before he gets the help we know he needs. And they said, yeah, until he presents as a danger. And I said, well, what happens if he's successful on his first attempt? And guess what? He was successful on his first attempt. So as a parent, I leaned on the side of involuntary help for him because he'd be here.
Jane, how does it work? The dynamics are obviously different with children. How does it work for parents who think that their child needs some inpatient hospitalization?
Yeah. Well, what we'll see sometimes is something that's a little bit parallel in that a parent will seek treatment for their child. For whatever reason, they won't be able to get treatment at the level that they think they need. And they will think that perhaps if they involve their child in the juvenile justice system, that they'll get the treatment they need. And that usually doesn't work very well. This isn't a system that's equipped to provide mental health treatment. So usually those are kids that end up then in a system that becomes a little bit more punitive than it does become supportive. And you mentioned hospitalization for kids. That's a real interesting concept.
We've had a decline. Let's see. I have the numbers. Oh, nice segue. Thank you. In 1993, DHHS reported there were 729 inpatient psychiatric beds for children across the state, 3,041 for adults. In 2018, we have 276 beds for children. That's down from 729 25 years ago. And we're down a little, considerably less, down to 2,100, 2,200 beds for adults. But that's a pretty significant drop in available beds for children.
It's a significant drop in the number of beds, in the location of beds. Good luck if you're from Traverse City or somewhere north like that and you want to seek hospitalization for your child. It's going to, closest will be Grand Rapids, so that's pretty interesting. When you think about a 6 or 7-year-old in a psych hospitalization that's 200 miles away, not a lot of opportunity for family involvement. If you can get your child in that hospital, had a call from a parent the other day who had been in an emergency room with their 11-year-old for 14 days waiting for a hospital bed. Hate to say it, but this isn't unusual. Our beds are limited in number, and we have providers, hospitals aren't prepared to its staff to deal with some of the big behaviors and the acuity. They just can't handle some of the pieces and that they need to. And unfortunately, some of our licensing regulations are working against us in that they can't, they can't restrain a child even to keep that child safe. So it's a really complicated issue, and I think that our kids really suffer.
Where I got those numbers was actually directly from a report that three of you on this panel worked on that just came out in February, the Michigan Inpatient Psychiatric Admissions Discussion, in talking about this decline in available psychiatric beds for both children and adults. Bob, it's a 60-page report. There's a lot of detail in there. For the audience here, what's the main takeaways? What did you guys come up with? What's the main takeaway?
So I'll do the best to remember this, you guys, so jump in.
And jump in, yeah.
So what it found is there was no one silver bullet solution. There were a mix of them. Staffing at higher levels in community hospitals, because we're talking about behaviorally challenged patients. We're not talking about sedated, depressed patients. That's actually what they were built for. They were built for people who were having a bad week and decided to take a break. Well, when you have somebody come in now who's behaviorally challenged, violent, maybe sexually acting out, the hospital's thrown off. And hospitals have a right not to accept people if they can't care for them. So what we found is there were 20, we did a survey for 6 months, 20 calls per person who came to a CMH before they found an open bed. 20 calls. And as Jane says, sometimes these hospitals weren't in the hometown at all. They were hundreds of miles away. So one is staffing. The second is physical plant. One of the hospital administrators had a great quote. They said, I run a 4-bed ward, meaning, one large room with 4 beds. And if I get a person in that ward who has violent behaviors, I now have a 1-bed ward, right? So now I've lost 3 beds because you can't put 3 other people in that same ward. So a physical plant, in that case, you need 3 walls is what you need. But those changes can't happen. And then the third thing Jane alluded to, which is community alternatives. currently licensing, you can't put a kid or an adult in a group home setting, and if he or she tries to harm themselves or others, you're not allowed to touch the person. You would your own kid. You'd say, go to your room. But you can't. And so we're working with the House and Senate to change that law to allow to protect the kid or adult and or those around them. You're allowed to touch them or ask them to go to their room or take the knife out of their hand, which is anybody would say that's natural. That will expand the options because some of the bed demand for the hospitals, hospitalization is not appropriate. It's just the only safe place where you can actually restrain and seclude somebody. Whereas in most group homes, once the laws change, you'll be able to do that too. So I think there'll be a lot of improved lower demand and a lot greater access. But I missed so much of that report. You
guys. Well, there are so many gaps. And I was talking to a hospital administrator down in metropolitan Detroit who's actually expanding psychiatric beds. DMC Hospital currently has 19 beds. They're expanding, adding another 31 beds, so they'll get up to a 50-bed ward.
Adults only.
Yeah, and great distinction. But I talked to another hospital administrator in a rural area. They're building a new hospital, and they're eliminating all their psych beds. And it's interesting to talk to get the perspective of either, because the Scott Steiner, who's the CEO at DMC, he said, you know, we feel that we have a responsibility to the community to do this. This is not just about making money. Where the other administrator said, I'm eliminating my beds because I can't make money on it. It's not profitable. And they don't feel the same sense of community responsibility or corporate responsibility. So, you know, when we closed all the psychiatric hospitals, and I'm paraphrasing, so don't quote me, I had some conversation with some folks over at DHHS, and they said the idea was they expected a better partnership with the private hospitals, but they can't force them to do some things. So that becomes a gap.
And thank you for that segue into profitability.
We're just rolling along.
Yes, that's right. How to summarize the 298 work group thing for everyone who's not familiar. Let's see. Currently, there is an effort underway to look at integration of behavioral and physical health services in Michigan. There is great evidence that this is, you know, you treat the body and the mind, it all works in one. Now, where the debate comes is it's a $2.6 billion Medicaid behavioral health system. And who controls it? Private health plans would like to have a control over it. The CMHs and the PIHPs, the community mental health organizations, would like to maintain their control. But we are now, fast forward to pilot projects, right now looking at how to do this, how to best integrate behavioral and mental health services in a way that has outcomes, that proves cost-effective, you know, all of the factors. We have three projects at least right now that may go in Genesee County, a Community Mental Health Authority, Saginaw County Community Mental Health Authority, and Muskegon and West Michigan Mental Health Authority. Kevin, a lot of you have been working on this. Where are we with this? We've talked over the last year. Actually, a lot of us talked over the last year about this.
So we might all have to back up and get a little room here. Because there are very opinions about this. 298, quite frankly, and if I could sum it up in a word and a half, is
good luck.
A mess. It is an absolute mess. How we got here is a mess, and where we are is a mess, and where it's going is a potential hot mess. Because we don't know. And I mean that with...
Man, I wish I was him. He is so good at this.
See, as an advocate, I get to know. So... First of all, I think we all support integrated health care. We do believe that the mind and the body are connected, should be treated as one. There's no dissension on that. The problem is, well, the question becomes who provides it. Now, personally, I believe in the public system. I just do. And that's my personal preference. But I don't have a dog in the fight when it comes to who gets paid. If I truly believe that the health plans could build a better mousetrap and do it better, I would support it. I really would. The problem is we're at this juncture where we're having these pilot tests. And in the 2 years we've been working on this, I've not heard one person from a health plan or one legislator who supported this move articulate why they believe the health plans could do it better. So that's where I struggle. And I kind of look at it like, what was the Popeye? Remember Wimpy and Popeye? He always said, give me a hamburger today and I'll gladly pay you tomorrow. That's where I feel like we're at. It's give us the $2.6 billion and we'll show you our hand later. And my problem is you want the money, show me what you can deliver. And right now, and I'm still very much involved in 298, and I'm a part of a lot of conversations across the state, and I can tell you, the health plans don't know how they're going to do this. So my disappointment, and let me throw my disclaimer out there, as an individual and as an advocate, I don't concern myself with political party. I don't care if you're Democrat, Republican, independent, conservative. I don't even know what most of that means. I could care less. I'm an issues-based person. And so when I look at that issue, I struggle because the legislature asked us. We spent 16 months in a room. The legislature admitted we don't really understand the delivery of mental health services. So they put together what was called the Cali Work Group, which Bob and I and Jane all participated in. We're in a room for 16 months. Can't tell you how many times we met. And we provided them with the list of recommendations they asked us for. And to this date, I don't have any faith that anybody ever read those recommendations. They just announced, thank you very much, we're going to give this to the health plans. Now, again, I'm not anti-health plan, but I'll say this, and we talk about wraparound, and I'll try to be a little more brief. The public behavioral health system is designed to seek people out who are in need of treatment and services and provide it to them. Health plans, by their very nature, are designed to mitigate risk and cost. It's just the nature of the business. So they're not built for it. They're simply just naturally not built for this sector of population, I'll say.
Bob, do you want to weigh in on this?
I'm going to get a beer. So when 298 came out, it was in the governor's budget in 16. And with a lot of your help and advocates, we turned it back. We turned it back twice now. Three pilots, as Kevin says, what's happening. We're taking a different tack. About a year ago, some advocates and smarter people like Jane and Judge Mack and Kevin said to me, hey, you know, this defensive posture probably ain't going to work. Why don't we go on the offensive? And the offensive is we have a better mousetrap. So we're actually in our conference coming up in Novi on April 30th. We're bringing in three other states, Arkansas, New York, and Colorado, who have done a public-private partnership. If you want a cool term, it's called P3. That's the new term. So the next cocktail party can say, oh, yeah, I'm doing some P3 stuff. That's what. But it means there is a role for the private sector. A lot of the vendors are private. There's a role for the private sector. But the core has got to be a public sector role. Public governance, public statutory safety net protections, public system. For example, your local CMH, they're not just a provider in your hometown. They convene homeless seminars. They work to deal with special ed kids. They work to deal with the employment crisis. They work to deal with urban renewal. You don't see a single health plan doing that. In fact, one of the rules that I always use is, my members always say this, when there's a fire in the hometown or somebody gets arrested or something happens, the local judge or sheriff calls me as a CMH director at 2 in the morning. Do they call the health insurance company executive at 2 in the morning? No. That's the difference. It's night and day. That's not their job. So there's a role for private insurance. I'm not against it. But Kevin's right. It's the wrong model, business model, for running a risk-seeking as opposed to a risk-averse system. I'm a believer that these pilots are going to show us. University of Michigan is going to do the research. We met with the researchers 2 weeks ago. They're real serious about this. They're going to evaluate the pilots. I have to be Pollyannish because in a political environment, science doesn't matter, right? I mean, if it shows that these things don't work, there's a way to spin it politically to say it didn't work for some other reason. But we're hoping the researchers will be real, and they are, and the research will be real, and the public can look at the data and say, it looks like this kind of thing works, this kind of thing doesn't.
You bring up a couple states. I just interject, I think Iowa is another state to Google.
Yeah.
And look at how it worked in Iowa. When there's a gubernatorial debate, it was 6 months ago, 3 or 4 months ago, when there's a gubernatorial debate almost a year out from the election about the collapse of the mental health system in your state, I think you know that there might be some issues there. So I think there's some instructive, both good and bad, and models going around. I want to just ask one kind of final question for everyone, and then we'll turn to your questions. You know, mental health is a pretty personal issue. It's a policy issue. But some of you touched on this already. But, you know, there's a lot of issues out there that we all could have cared about. I mean, I cover everything in Michigan, from environment to education to politics to whatever. Why do you personally care about mental health? Why have you devoted your career and your lives to this issue, Judge May?
Well, as a probate judge, I heard mental health cases. I heard thousands of mental health cases. And day after day, it was nothing but frustration. I felt like I was in a revolving door and couldn't get out. I couldn't help anybody. My time was being used up for no good purpose. It seemed terribly unjust. And if you're a judge, the last thing you want to do is be part of a system of injustice. And so I just started agitating. And the more I agitated, I got more agitated. And I just built on that. And actually, in 2004, I ended up being on the governor's mental health commission, at which point I made a number of suggestions that were adopted but didn't go anywhere. But along the way, I would continue advocating anyway because I just felt it was wrong. You've got people who need help, and we won't help them. I don't understand that. I would, you know, someone's in the water, they're drowning, you've got a life preserver handy. Wouldn't you throw it to them, you know, or take it out to them or do something? Why would you let them drown? And it just bothered me. It still bothers me. And so that's my story.
And you're here and everywhere talking about this issue. Jane, why do you care?
Well, I think it was kind of a confluence of several things that brought me to that point. I went back to school and got my master's in social work. And so, you know, I was going to save the world because that's what you do. Social workers. And my yes. And my first job was in a prison that was built for youth who were 14 to 20 who had been adjudicated as adults. Think about that. A 20-year-old or a 14-year-old with a life sentence. And when I took that first job and started looking around, I kind of said to myself, you know what? Something's wrong here, because a lot of these guys wouldn't have ended up here if they'd had what they needed early on. And as I was taking that job is when my son was beginning his school career in kindergarten and first grade, and the wheels came off the bus. And I had that kind of feeling that my kid could end up in that kind of a setting. And so I think it was those three things that brought me to this place of, you know what, whether it's one at a time or whether it's trying to change systems, I think I kind of sort of got to do it. And I'm Dutch, and I'm stubborn, so that's why.
Kevin?
I just wanted to work with Bob.
No. And I want to sound like Kevin, so we're a perfect pair.
No, you know, obviously, my son's diagnosis and subsequent death brought me into the system. What really keeps me going, and I mean this sincerely, is the hope, the recovery is possible model. When I talk to somebody about, like Jane, who has a son who's has a mental health diagnosis, but the kid is graduating with an aerospace engineering degree, that's recovery. That's hope. That's living proof that the stigma's wrong. And there's another side. The other piece of it I look at is all of the social ills we could cure if we had a better mental health system. Think about it. When we talk about suicide being the second leading cause of death for young people between the age of 15 and 24, 90% of the people who die by suicide have underlying mental health issues. We'll lose about 50,000 people in this country to suicide this year. That means 45,000 could be saved. That's hopeful to me. When I think about how it would improve or reduce homelessness, unemployment, underemployment, incarceration rate, all of those things can be very quickly addressed if we have a better mental health system. So that's what gets me out of bed every day to fight this fight, because I think it's worth fighting. Can't fight it for my son, but I can fight it for so many others.
Bob, why do you do this?
So people ask me, you know, how'd you get in the mental health business? And I say, I'm not in the mental health business. I'm in the social justice business. And I got into it a long time ago. And what I realized is some of the most marginalized, disenfranchised folks in our society are the mentally ill and folks with IDD, sorry, developmental disabilities. And so our job is to make sure that's not true, that they have the right to live in decent housing, find jobs, fall in love with who they want, worship where they want, walk where they want, play where they want, do the stuff that all of us as citizens have a right to do. I mean, it's a social justice movement. I mean, it's ironic they're having this today, you know, the anniversary of the death of MLK, because if you read the stuff that reminds you of him, whatever he was working on, we're still working on it now. I mean, those issues aren't going away. So that's what motivates me. So I'm not discouraged by this. Is a movement still. I always tell you can tell it's a movement because the clients have to change their names as a group about every couple of years, right? They're patients and then recipients, then clients and consumers, right? That always tells you that group feels at the bottom of the totem pole, because white men don't change our name of our group very often because we don't have to. Those marginalized do. That always tells me there's still a movement, because it can also be pushed aside. As Joe opened the whole thing, this whole thing is pushed aside all the time. People say, yeah, I care about it because there was a shooting, but then in a couple of days, I'm caring more about the Kardashians or some other issue. That's the problem, and that's why we know it's a movement that's got a long way to go.
So I want to open it up to questions. A couple things. First, Lindsay is going to go around the room. She'll hold the mic. If I could just have two humble requests. I know this is a very personal issue. I want to get to as many questions as possible. So if you can keep it as brief as possible and focus it towards a question to the panel, please.
Okay. My question is, I feel that I loved this conversation. In the entire part, though, we lacked talking about children of parents with a mental illness, and I think that's a crucial component because a lot of times if there aren't strong figures in the child's life, they end up with a mental illness and we're worse off. So I'm wondering what programs and supports do you guys currently have, if you have any, or have you guys given any thought to implementing programs for children?
Jane, you want to start on that one?
You know, I know specifically about a professor at Michigan State who's doing some work with the kids of parents who have mental health challenges. And a lot of her work is really about informing the kids, educating them, supporting them, empowering them, and reducing the stigma that they feel. And then I think the part that we don't always connect to that, you know, we might provide treatment and services to the parent. You know, I talked about, you know, when you provide services to a kid, you got to admit they're part of a family. They're not this little. The opposite is true. When you provide services and treatment to that parent, you got to think they're part of a unit too. And I don't think we've done a really good job on it, but I do see some stuff coming almost with that adult wraparound approach we've talked about. So I think it's both pieces, helping the kids and youth to understand and then looking at that as that unit.
Well, I think there's a second reason. It's sort of funded as a flawed model, right? Because the kid's not the patient. The adult is, right? And so our model is set up, though, I got to see the patient to get paid. And so there's a lot of movements to say, let's de-link those two things. And also, imagine the parent says, I don't want to be a patient anymore, and he or she leaves. The kids are saying, could I keep talking, if you don't mind? So we don't have a structure for that legally, and we'd like to be able to do that. I think we're starting to break down these walls. People are saying, those kids need somebody to talk to. First, they're afraid to admit their mom and dad have troubles. They're afraid to admit what they're struggling with, and so they deny it. And they would love to get together with other kids saying, how are you doing with that? And have an adult say, yeah, I think we're a ways from that. You can see the options are obvious. We just got to find a way to break down some of the fiscal barriers. I shouldn't say fiscal barriers. Stack up a fiscal stack, actually, of dollars is what we need. So
we have another question over there.
Doing this. So my question has to do with communication about how we talk about gun violence and mental illness. There's a lot of conversation about the folks that are doing the violence are the ones that have the mental illness issue, yet it's been proven that the folks that have mental illness are more likely to be the victims of gun crime. How do we talk to people about that specific subject so that we don't continue to make mental illness people with mental illness have the stigma of being somebody that might shoot you, and talk about the fact that they are actually more likely to be victims.
Judge Mack, you want to start?
Well, some things we know right now. For example, if you have a mental illness and you're stopped by the police, your chance of being shot and killed is 16 times higher than anyone else. And And while the data does show that persons with mental illness are more often the victims of crime than the perpetrators of crime, the fact that there are persons who have a mental illness and they're in trouble and they're getting guns does need to be addressed. And, for example, the red flag laws are an example of a way to address that issue and take guns away from people who are, in fact, dangerous. And then, to me, it gets that issue off the table, and we go back to the initial point of early intervention to help people with their mental illness get better and focus on that and not limit this conversation to the shooting issue. I think it needs to be dealt with separately and promptly and move on.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, and really quickly, I'd like to see, and I'm not, I have to give an exception to my friend Joe here, but I'd like to see the media do a better job. How they report these shootings and always linking it to mental illness is not fair, and it's not right. And it furthers the stigma and misleads the public. And the media has to take some responsibility for how they report these stories.
So I think partly what you're doing is sharing facts with people who say that to you. You know that most of the folks who commit, we did an op-ed in the paper. Right. Well, except what we said, you got to point the fact out that only 4% of all violent crimes are committed by people with mental illness. 4%. In fact, we did an op-ed in the paper covered in a lot of papers that said that pointed out very few people going what Kevin said. The second point you got to make is bring that fact up over and over again. That's not how it works. And in fact, you remember when the Virginia Tech shooting happened? Everybody said, well, we knew this kid was trouble. And what they really meant was he should have been arrested. We don't believe in this country arresting people before they commit a crime, believe it or not. We really don't. Well, unless you're black, yeah, I guess we do. Sorry.
That's another issue.
That's a different...
That's our next...
We can segue right into that. But I was at a... There's a new... there's a big movement called the Community Intervention Movement, which is about when you see a young person struggling like that, you reach out and you support them. and you give them, because often they're isolated, but what we do is we expel them, we fire them, they become more isolated and more armed. Actually, we all would, actually, and you got pushed that way. So, and they tend not to be the bullies, they tend to be the bullied. So once we realize that dynamic, our job is don't let that happen to kids. Reach out to and pull them in. But helping your friends see the facts is a good way to defang this idea that it's the mental illness. You're welcome.
Yeah. I just want to quickly tag a question out of that to Judge Mack. Judge, you one of the things you talk about a lot is advanced training for law enforcement, more nuanced training. How much of this conversation we have in the public right now that was mentioned by the questioner about linking mental illness and violence is a lot of the public that doesn't know these issues kind of following the lead of our law enforcement and how they treat these folks?
Well, there's a thing called crisis intervention training, or CIT, which is designed to help law enforcement deal with people who have mental illness. And it's being deployed more and more around the country. In fact, Oakland County is doing it, and they have found that by having that kind of training, the police are having better outcomes when it comes to dealing with people in non-mental health situations. And I would just make reference to Miami-Dade County. The judge down there got a mental health court going, and he had CIT training for all law enforcement in Miami-Dade County. And with that CIT training and diversion, they closed a jail with 12,000 beds. They reduced their cost by $12 million. They reduced their workers' compensation premium because police officers weren't being injured in dealing with persons with issues. And people with issues weren't being shot. So when they went to New York to have the bond rating reviewed, the bonding agency said, well, shootings are down, your bond premium is going up. So there's all kinds of benefits to this, but the CIT training needs to be done not just for law enforcement, but it needs to be done in hospital emergency rooms, because people with mental illness often show up at hospital emergency rooms for help, and in that situation, they can sometimes be a bit disorderly, get in trouble, and next thing you know, the police are called, someone's arrested, now they're charged with a felony. So that CIT training is critical across all those who interact with persons who are in a bad way with mental illness.
Real, what has to happen for that to get going?
It has to be funded.
Yeah. Well, and let me address that really quickly, because funding was the issue. And the reason funding was an issue is crisis intervention training is a 40-hour training. So your law enforcement agencies are faced with taking officers off the street for a week, and then having to backfill their position, so they're faced with having to pay for the overtime. So it could be very costly. Now, NAMI provides CIT training, and I just talked to a police captain in Lansing 2 weeks ago, and they went through it, and they found a way to significantly reduce the cost. There are federal grants out there for crisis intervention training for law enforcement agencies, but we're finding ways to make it more cost effective. And I'll throw another real quick statistic at you. NAMI did a study 4 or 5 years ago, and we found at that time that only 5% of the nation's law enforcement officers had received crisis intervention training. But in those instances where it had been provided, the instance of violence was reduced by over 80%. So that makes it safer for the police, for law enforcement officer, and for the citizen.
Another question?
Yeah.
Hi. This is a pretty specific question. The Kevin's Law, AOT, I am wondering how it gets paid for if the person is not a Medicaid recipient.
Can you just remind what AOT means for everyone?
The assisted outpatient treatment.
Great.
The judge.
Okay. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Judge?
I asked Bob.
We're punting, Bob.
Yep.
So let me tell you the problem. I think I said if you're not on Medicaid, there's $7.50 available per citizen in Michigan. It doesn't take very... I mean, if AOT was used effectively, and Judge Mack and I both agree it's got to be used. I mean, I wish more judges were comfortable, but it's complicated, right? But it was used more often, and there was funding for it. I think people's lives would get improved. But I'm not kidding. You have $120 million statewide for the entire mental health system that's not on Medicaid. $120 million, really, for the whole state. That's why it's $750. So that's the problem. And it's a, I mean, people always say, don't talk about money. And I say, yeah, but when it's something you care about, you always talk about money. So we got to care about this. Because AOT is a whole lot better than getting people arrested. I mean, that's the problem. People get hurt, end up in psychiatric hospitals, they drop out of school, they get divorced, they end up homeless, unemployed. We can intervene early, but we got to pay for it.
I might add that when the Community Mental Health Act in 1963 was adopted, it was actually a two-part bill. The first part was deinstitutionalization. The second part was the creation of a comprehensive outpatient community-based system. Well, guess what? They forgot to fund the second part. They did the deinstitutionalization, but flunked the part about replacing it with an outpatient system. And so far, Congress has failed to fund that program in the last 70 years.
Yes.
Oh, thanks. I'm from Lenawee County, and I think Kevin actually talked about our hospital. Our hospital closed their inpatient services last year. They're building a new hospital, I think, by 2020 with no inpatient services. So we're sending people across the state to Grand Rapids, Auburn Hills, Washtenaw, everywhere. The new bill that they're working on, the new you talked about, I'm not sure how it's going to help us, but I did hear that they're talking about putting a requirement for hospitals, if they have a certain amount of people in the hospital working there, that they would have to have mental health services? Is that true or not?
There is talk about that requiring, it's called a certificate of need. To get a certificate of need approved, you have to agree to have provide psychiatric care. It's not been passed. It's not been implemented, so there is talk. I mean, I want to go back to something Judge Mack said. Once we stopped using state hospitals, and I'm a believer that we shouldn't use state hospitals. Most of that was medical incarceration most of the time. But if we're going to use a private sector model of a market then, if that's what we've chosen, I think we have, then we've got to make the market incentives work. And one of the reasons hospitals don't run inpatient psychiatric units is it scares all the rest of the patients away. I mean, it's still stigmatized, right? People don't want to say, yeah, I had my baby. It was right next to the psychiatric ward. No. So, and hospitals have to market their services. So we have a long way to go to get that stigma reduced and to allow hospitals to open their doors again, because as Joe pointed out, we've had a dramatic drop. Now, some of the hospital beds weren't needed. We were hospitalizing lots of people who are better serving the community. But the pendulum, most of us agrees, too far that way. We could use a couple hundred more hospital beds so you don't have to spend 14 days in the ER waiting to get in. So I think that there's a debate. Again, this is the public-private debate. How do you incentivize a private system, the private market, to take customers they don't want, to be frank? That's not easy.
Yes.
Just a comment. You spent the first 45 minutes talking about real problems in the mental health system, and then you switched to Section 298, and that's got nothing to do with any of the issues you talked about.
Oh,
and the managed care companies taking over the system, but $52 million is what you can expect those managed care companies to milk out of the system. That's about 2%. What they'll do is what they've done in other states. They'll take that money off the top. They'll contract back with the same systems. And the other thing I'm going to comment on, and I know this because I worked at the state level, the state has got no capacity to manage that system if it's sent privately. Right now the system is mission-driven, for better or for worse. The people that are in it are relatively mission-driven, and they're in the public light. They're accountable publicly. These managed care plans are not. So you're talking about a real mess. I'll be interested to see the evaluation. I already know how it's going to go. Other states that have done this have had to take and put their mental health systems back together. But I have a question for Judge Mack. This is a very specific question. And this gets back to some of your comments about people requiring treatment and why it is they don't get addressed in the court as needing treatment. And one of my observations is the judges don't often apply sections 401C and 401D. And I'd like you to speak to why that is.
Actually, that's incorrect. The cases that go to trial in Michigan, judges enter orders for treatment in 98.5% of the cases. And you can go to the Supreme Court's website and see the data. Judges order treatment under A, B, and C all the time. D, on the other hand, is the old Kevin's Law, which is extremely difficult to apply. The fact is the judges are trying to get 401C modified so it's capacity-based, so that people are ordered into treatment based on lack of capacity and not based on other considerations.
I want to quickly follow up on another point. In your 298 negotiations or ongoing work group conversation, whatever the term is for it now, negotiations is not proper. Did you ask representatives at DHHS or Senator Marlow, Senator Shirky, some of the folks leading these things, how is the state going to oversee this? How is the state going to oversee it if we shift it to the health plans?
Well,
how much that would cost?
We did. I want to echo what was said in the audience. When we look at states across the country, and we'll hear this from everyone, most states move to a private insurance-based model because the state doesn't want to oversee it. It's too complicated. If they can say, well, did they balance a budget? Do we know what we're paying them every month? There are some grievance procedures, but ask most Medicaid recipients if they know how to grieve their physical health care. There's a large recipient rights system on the mental health side that has lots of grievances. I mean, that's what we actually seek. So I think most states, and I hope not Michigan, aren't concerned with overseeing it. They're concerned with offshoring their obligations, which I think is a problem.
Is there any other questions? We have one up here, Lindsay.
Given the politics that you mentioned as being a barrier, what do you think are the most effective arguments that citizens can make to try to influence the decisions that are made through the budget on the mental health code and other things and help bring this up higher on the state's priorities?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, you do it every day.
Go vote. Yeah. Vote them out. I think it's just that simple. We do a terrible job, I think, in this country of holding our elected officials accountable. And again, I don't care what side of the party line you're on. Politicians make promises to us. They tell us that we feel your pain, we understand, we're on your side. And then when they go to office, they don't follow through. It's incumbent upon us to hold them accountable. And the only way we can do that is through our vote. We as advocates don't have the opportunity to sway votes with money. We can't make campaign contributions. We can't do those things. Quite frankly, I think money played a role in how we got to where we are at 298, and I don't think anybody can dispute it. Our only weapon is our vote. So you have to go and vote.
Let me add to that, if you don't mind. So an ad for Michigan Radio, they did a story, Joe, about a year ago on campaign financing?
Last April, I think.
Last April. Yeah, mm-hmm. Go on their website and look it up. It's stunning. They did a study on, during this 298 debate, how much money was given by the private side who wanted the whole budget, $2.6 billion, versus what we gave. So here's a stat I always use. Our whole association, in its PAC money, in a whole year, to all the House and Senate members, gives as much as one family gave to one senator on one day. That's what we're talking about. So I always use the quote, these guys are sick of hearing me saying it, all the guns and money are on their side, but the reason we turned 298 back is we had 1,000 peasants with pitchforks and cell phones. And that's what did it. It was people talking. And there were thousands of people. In fact, we used to go to the Capitol, they'd say, tell your people to stop calling me. I said, these aren't my people, they're citizens calling you. So I think that's what we have to do. Call and vote.
I just got to echo it. I mean, it was the voices and it was the vote, and you can't stop. You have to keep at it. You can't say it once. It's over and over and over. And sharpen your pitchforks.
Well, one of the challenges we face, too, is that Michigan has very strict term limits. So people are elected. If you're in the House, you're elected for 6 years. And usually if you're running for state House or state Senate, it's because you're a former county commissioner, you're bothered about the roads formula and fixing potholes, and you've got all these other issues. And someone comes along and says, what about mental illness? And you're like, what about what? And if you're lucky, you'll educate this legislator on the intricacies of the mental health code before they're limited out. Yeah. And that, so that's a really severe obstacle that we face. So it really does take significant citizen involvement all the time, and over and over and over again, because you're getting new people over and over again. We have in this particular house, the Speaker of the House is probably the best friend we've had when it comes to fixing the mental health system. He's got less than 8 months to go, and he's gone. And who's the next speaker? I don't know. It might be someone who cares about banks. Who knows? But that's the problem we face. So letters count. Phone calls count. And when they're asking people to have them stop calling, it's because they're uncomfortable. Make them uncomfortable. That's the whole point.
Yes, over here.
I don't know if this is on topic or not, but what is an intervention for gun control and reducing the number of students who are shot?
There's a red flag law which is in place in some states like Connecticut. And basically, it's like a personal protection order. So if you have someone who is threatening violence, is out of control, and you're concerned about guns, you go to a judge. The judge issues an order to have the guns picked up. Then they have a hearing within 2 weeks to see what the situation is and decide whether or not the guns can go back or not. If a person is hospitalized involuntarily, they lose the guns for a year, for example. So that's in that way, you can address an immediate dangerous situation. But, you know, think about the Florida shooting. That young man would not have qualified as mentally ill in Michigan. So, and I know they've criticized the FBI and DHHS for not doing anything. And my question is, okay, so what could they have done exactly? They had no legal authority to do anything except wait for disaster, because that's where laws are currently written. So if you had a red flag law in Florida at that time, you could have gone in and picked up those weapons. But that's what I'm suggesting might be useful in our purposes.
Let me add to that. The day after the Parkland shooting, our association put out a resource guide of really sound concepts. I'll send it to Joe if we can get it out. We just formed a guns and violence subcommittee at our association. We'll be putting out recommendations soon that are a humane, sound approach. But let me tell you what they're not. They're not about hardening our schools to make them fortress PS 405. And the reason for that is you give people a false sense of security. So they go from one safe hub to another safe hub. Come on, really? So I tell you, that kid's going to go home at night when they leave that safe hub and walk through the neighborhood, right? Or come home. Come on. We want our whole community safe. It's not a school safety issue. It is, but not alone. We want everything safe. Our grocery stores, our parks, our churches, everything safe. And there are ways to do that. So I'll send the packet to Joe.
And just to clarify, for those who don't know, there is a red flag bill that has been introduced in the legislature, but it's looking like it's probably not going to move. We could listen to stateside. We can talk to some of the committee chairs on that. But I think there are issues about due process that I've heard on a number of sides that are worried about taking someone's constitutional right to a gun away. Again, maybe another issue is a nail. But yeah.
So you've talked about some of the successes with the CIT training on the police force. Are there discussions about some kind of parallel training for our educators so that we can get mental wellness into our education system?
So we have mental health first aid, mental health first aid for children. NAMI offers a number of programs, one called Parents and Teachers as Allies, where we help school professionals recognize young people who may be experiencing a mental health crisis and connect them and their families to local resources. So there are a number of things that are out there, but it can always be improved.
One more question. All right, back over there, Lindsay.
It wasn't moving.
No,
Right? We're giving Lindsay a workout here.
Get her steps in the day.
Just picking up on the education question that was just brought up, I work as an education advocate. So some of my clients have mental health issues. And one of the things I haven't heard is how do we bring mental health help into a school in a holistic way? Because picking up a kid and bringing them into the judicial system doesn't help them. At the same time, tasking a school with dealing with a child who has serious mental health issues is problematic because they don't have the resources, they don't have the support, they don't have the personnel. And we have laws or rules. We have people who own little parts of what they do and they don't want to share. So CMH coming into a school is very problematic. Sorry, we can't do that. That's not allowed. But I have a kid who's not going to make it through life because you're being territorial. At the same time, the school can't provide this child with a way to successfully manage themselves in school and not end up in a courtroom. I can't tell you how many times I've seen children end up with a teacher calling the police, not the school, but a teacher. And then the kid ends up in the juvenile justice system where they get little to nothing unless they are lucky enough to live in Allegan County.
Jane, you want to take have you had to tackle educating and dealing with mental health issues in a child's life? I'm sure you have.
Yeah, personally and kind of professionally. And I think part of it is about back to that concept of first destigmatizing. Look, this is everybody's kid. And they have mental health challenges, and other kids have other challenges. We got it. This is everybody's kid. And all of those systems that you mentioned have to, again, jump out of their little silos. I do not expect a teacher to provide mental health care. I really don't. They're there to educate, but they get to have a little bit of knowledge, and they have to have some background about mental health issues. They have to, and I don't expect the mental health provider to be the educator, and, you know, vice versa. But I think, again, we've got to start really changing the way we look at it about turf and silos and territory and my funding pot and your funding pot, and, you know, kind of cut that out and just say, this is a kid. We got to come together and figure out how, with an individualized, collaborative and cooperative plan, how we're going to help this kid be successful, how we're going to support him, how we're going to support their family, how we're going to support the teacher. And I'm certainly not thinking that cutting all the funding for school social workers or any other kind of supports that might exist would be the answer.
All right. I would like to just end on a high note here, or higher note. I'd like each of you to just tell me what you're hopeful about that's changing right now in Michigan's mental health system. What gives you optimism? What gives you hope? What makes you want to keep doing this work? Judge Mack?
Why am I first?
I'll go over here. I don't want to make it first. Bob?
So a couple things. I mean, one is the interventions are there. We know how to actually do this stuff. We know how to get that a kid in school is in trouble. We know how to help that senior who's abusing opiates. We know how to do this stuff. What we lack is political will, and in a democracy, political will, to be frank, is demonstrated through the state and federal and city budgets. It is. I mean, a friend of mine says a federal and state and city budget is a moral document, and I believe that, actually. It tells you how you're going to spend your money. When I hear people say, well, we don't need money, we just got to be more creative, they never say that about what they're voting for, though. The stuff they care about, I mean, I would always say, is that how you treat your kids? We just got to be more creative. They haven't eaten in a couple days, but kid, be more creative. You wouldn't say that. So I think the moral will of a society, a democratic one, small d, is shown by how it spends its money. And you have to use a dirty word sometimes, and that's called taxes. You have to have a fundamental belief in the public system, which is what we're describing mostly. I could talk a long time about what to change in commercial insurance, but I'm hopeful of that. And I must tell you, some of the recent movements about women's rights and kids' rights and gun violence are encouraging. That people are saying, and whatever you think of the teachers' walkouts, whatever you think about those things, they're about people saying, I don't think the way it works now is good. And maybe, as Kevin said, we can take political and fiscal action to make that happen.
Kevin, what gives you hope?
Honestly, the people in this room. I didn't expect that we'd have this number of people come out and talk about this conversation tonight. So what's hopeful to me is you. And my request is that let's not let it end in this room, and let's not let it end in your households. We have a voice. We can vote. We can come out and participate in activities like Walk a Mile and all of those other things that help us destigmatize this issue. So you give me hope, and I'm asking you to spread that and get more people involved in this movement, because we can change things. There may not be the political will now, but it is because of our combined voices that we can change that. So you're my hope.
Jane, what gives you hope?
Yeah, well, kind of echoing what Kevin said, and also the fact that, you know, we've all referred to this. This is a movement. It's a movement that is gaining momentum. And so it just kind of feels like we come out from under the rock or something where we've had to hide for a really long time, that we can be really open, that there are people who are using their fame and their dollars and all of those sorts of things. And that's really good. Don't get me wrong. But even more than that, it's that kind of grassroots thing. It is the thousands of people who are they themselves receiving services in the public mental health system, or their child is, who literally took the time and energy to come to these affinity groups and talk about 298 and say really specifically what they wanted. It's the strong advocacy efforts that we have in this state. And I mean, it is powerful. I got to be the first to tell you. It's all of those things that are giving me hope. It's those little tiny pieces of peer-to-peer people reaching out and supporting each other. All of those things make me be kind of hopeful. And as Kevin said, the fact that everybody is here, this is really kind of shocking to me, and very positive. So, yeah, it's hopeful. So kind of pay it forward.
Judge Mack?
So we have a system that's badly organized and badly funded. Aside from that, you know, we do have a lot of talented, committed people who are trying to provide the services in the system. But I'll tell you, when I will feel good is when Michigan's prison population of people with severe mental illness begins to decline. Then I'll start to feel better. But I actually do feel, as I'm thinking about this, that when I became state court administrator, I attended the Conference of State Court Administrators, which are all the state court administrators, and they're looking to do a policy paper. So I said, hey, I'll do mental health. And they're like, well, we don't normally do that. And I mentioned, well, you know, I think it's kind of a big deal. And a couple of members said, I had an aunt, I had an uncle. Yeah, let's do this paper. So I did the paper, and the conference endorsed it unanimously, as did the Conference of Chief Justices. So these are the judicial leaders throughout the country who unanimously endorse the concepts behind the paper, which includes early intervention, assisted outpatient treatment, and the sequential intercept model. So I don't know if we're going to pull it off in Michigan, but I'm hoping we're going to pull it off somewhere, and it's going to start to build a wave. But I think Kevin really nailed it. He did too. The truth is, it's this large crowd of people. I can assure you that 20 years ago when I was doing this agitation, I was talking to an empty room. Now, people care. People are involved. People are engaged. And we just have to build on that. And I think if we do build on that, then we can be successful. Because ultimately, this is about justice. And I think that's what we want.
I'd like to thank our incredible panel tonight. Let's give them a round of applause. Bob Sheehan is the CEO of the Community Mental Health Association of Michigan. Kevin Fisher is the executive director of NAMI Michigan. Jane Schenck is the executive director of the Association for Children's Mental Health. And Judge Milton Mack is Michigan State Court Administrator. One more time. Give him applause. Lastly, I'm Joe Lindstroth, executive producer of Stateside. Tune into our show in the next coming weeks. We have a recurring segment we call Minding Michigan, where we look at mental health and substance abuse issues in the state. And we'll be looking at more closely, if you're interested in some of the criminal justice things, there's a verdict called guilty but mentally ill. That's an alternative to not guilty by reason of insanity that started here in Michigan in the 70s. And looking at kind of how it's applied and what that means for people who enter the prison system with that verdict. That's coming up in the next couple of weeks. And lastly, I want to thank all of you for coming out on a windy, crazy, weather-driven Tuesday evening. Wednesday evening. Thank you very much. They're usually on Tuesdays. Wednesday evening. Thank you very much for your time tonight. Thank you. Thank you.